looking back at headlines in the month of July. As Maine moves through the summer of COVID-19, it is doing better than many other states, especially those in the South and West, where new cases and deaths are surging. But it's still really hard here, as seasonal businesses struggle and schools try to find out what fall will look like. Governor Mills this week expanded the number of people who could gather together, but most weddings have already been canceled. In politics, Maine's primary election went smoothly, despite worries. And now the race for U.S. Senate surges forward. And the state saw its first ever fatal shark attack, just 20 yards from shore. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We will talk about these stories and others with newspaper editors. Plus, we'll check in with Senator Angus King and a shark scientist. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. It is July 31st, believe it or not, and it is time to do our monthly look back at the headlines of the month. Today, we're joined by two editorial page editors, Ben Bragdon with the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel, and Greg Kessich with the Portland Press Herald and Sunday Telegram. As always, we want to hear from you. Which news stories are you following? Do you want to talk about? You can join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Email talk at mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post a comment to our Facebook page. But first, before we check in with Ben and Greg, on the line with us, Senator Angus King. Senator, thanks for giving us a call.
Jennifer, always a pleasure. Nice to be there with such distinguished company.
Oh, Greg and Ben, did you hear that?
We did.
Yeah. Yes, hey, listen, Senator.
They write things about me. I'm going to be nice to these guys.
Well, I want to talk about the chances of a relief plan today. This is the day that enhanced unemployment benefits end. I understand that Senate negotiators have been working around the clock. What is the very latest? What have you heard about a possible plan? Will it happen today?
I don't think so, Jennifer. The word I got late yesterday was that Senator McConnell wasn't even in the discussions, which is pretty disappointing. So I think the White House is actively trying to get something going. I know Chuck Schumer is, but Senator McConnell has just been AWOL. He can't seem to get his caucus together. He's got about 20-plus senators who don't want to do anything or close to nothing. And it's inexcusable that we're at this place where the deadline is today. Millions of people, 70,000 people in Maine are going to lose benefits as of today. And we've known this is coming. I mean, the House passed a bill in May, the middle of May, and here we are at the end of July. And Senator McConnell he never brought it up. He said he didn't feel any sense of urgency. He just wasn't interested. And then they were going to present a bill earlier this week. They came up with a sort of a half-baked proposal on Tuesday that didn't even have, I don't know if it had majority support in their caucus. And so we're sort of nowhere. And it's, Jennifer, it's just, like I say, it's really disappointing. A lot of people, I get these frustrated calls and letters from people saying, why don't you do something? People don't really realize, and I didn't until I got down here, that the Senate Majority Leader has total control over what comes to the Senate floor. If Mitch McConnell doesn't want a bill to come to the floor, it won't come up. The House has passed 300 or 400 bills this year that are sitting on his desk. And he could have brought this thing up. He could have started negotiations a month ago. I called Chuck Schumer on a Sunday, 3 weeks ago, and said, so have negotiations started? Not a peep. And here we are at the deadline, and there's not much going on. I'm hoping that there'll be some work done over the weekend and we can get this done early next week. But to be honest with you, Jennifer, I'm not terribly optimistic simply because the Senator McConnell and his caucus don't seem all that interested in getting something done.
So are you staying in Washington this weekend or are you coming home?
No, I'm here. I'm going to stay here and But I think a lot of folks have gone home, so there isn't much likelihood of anything happening today. I think at the earliest it would be the middle of next week. But if you can tell from my voice, this is really frustrating because it's unnecessary. Everybody knew we had to do something. I mean, we can negotiate about what it is we need to do, but to be nowhere now is just, it's inexcusable.
President Trump earlier this week tweeted he might try to move the election. As Mal Leary reported, both you and Senator Collins criticized that tweet. Is there any way, Senator King, is there any way that could happen?
No. Well, the only way it could happen is through an act of Congress. The Constitution makes clear that it's Congress that has the power to set election day, and they did so in 1948. I used to teach kids. Do you know the rule, Jennifer, for when a presidential election occurs? It's sort of fun. It's the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November of every even-numbered year, equally divisible by four. Can you repeat that five times for me?
No, but it made sense to me, so I'm going to take that as a.
But Congress and the president can't change it. Congress would have to change it. And there's no way Congress is going to change it. Look, we had elections. We had the election of 1864 in the middle of the Civil War. We had elections during the flu pandemic of 1918 during World War II. You know, we can do an election.
I'm going to bring Greg Kucich and Ben Bragdon in since we're all on the line together. Greg, do you have a question for the senator?
Yeah, Senator, maybe the president can't cancel an election, but he can certainly interfere with it. There's some stories coming out about the Postal Service that indicate that there's a real potential for absentee ballots not being able to reach the right place at the right time. And do you share that concern? Are there things that would need to be done now to protect the postal system, considering the way people are going to be voting in this election?
The answer is yes. I've disagreed with this president on an awful lot of things. But I think the worst thing he's done and is doing is undermining public confidence in our electoral system. This business of if I don't win, it's rigged, and there'll be the most crooked election in world history, and mail-in voting is, full of fraud. None of that is true. There are four states that have been doing all mail-in voting for years, I think decades. One of them is the radical left-wing state of Utah. I mean, this is a modern way that people can vote, and particularly in the coronavirus, we passed money in the CARES Act back in March to help the post office. And as far as I know, the administration has not released that money. The president has appointed a new postmaster general, and indications are that they're already slowing down the mail. So, I think a responsible president in this situation would be saying, we've got to build up the post office. Congress is ready to help the post office. The administration won't spend the money. And, the post office has taken a beating during the coronavirus. First class mail is down. And we ought to be this is something that's within the power of the administration to fix. I'm very worried about it. But I'm more worried, to tell you the truth, Greg, about this constant refrain that's trying to delegitimize the election. That's a strike at the heart of our democracy. Our system rests on trust. And I remember in one of my first government classes in college, the professor said, the secret of America that many countries around the world have never learned is the peaceful transfer of power. And that's what we've been able to do for over 200 years, even in intensely, contested elections like Florida in 2000. And this president is undermining the trust that is the heart of a democratic electoral system. It's awful, and he's going to keep doing it. It's putting himself before the country.
Ben, you have a question for Senator King.
Yeah, Senator Hara, thanks for coming in. Getting back to the relief package, we've been writing a lot about the need for a for a package that fits the size of the moment and how businesses, state and local governments, workers, they're all feeling the effects of this. And you mentioned the expiration of the unemployment benefits. If there's a further delay before there's a deal, if it's a week or two or even more, what do you think will be the effects on the ground will be? What can you say about what effect that'll have on people in Maine and throughout the country just in their day-to-day lives?
Well, let's take the extra unemployment benefits as an example. Not only is it going to have a drastic effect on the individuals, and I was on a Zoom call with a group of unemployed people, I think it was Monday, and, you know, there was a 54-year-old guy on the call who's worked all his life, and he's unemployed because of the coronavirus. It's through no fault of his own, and this benefit is helping him to keep his apartment, keep his family together, put food on the table. So there's going to be a direct effect on those. And by the way, the number in Maine is over 70,000 people. Mm. But then if you do the math, taking that $600 away from 70,000 people, that's over $40 million a week out of the Maine economy. Right. So the ripple effect, that's what's surprising to me about this is that the president and his party should desperately want to do this, because if they don't, the economy is really going to collapse. We already know how much it contracted in the second quarter, but you take that much money out of the economy and you take the child care supports and state and local governments are in huge difficulty. They're going to have to start laying off people. I've already talked to towns in Maine that are either doing layoffs, furloughs, or having budgets with vacancies of first responders, by the way. So the economic effect is going to be magnified if we aren't able to do this. What we're doing here is just trying to get us through the period where we can get to a vaccine. And by the way, we shouldn't even be here. We should have taken advantage of the work that was done in the spring, of the shutdown, of the distancing, and set up a nationwide testing program that would have helped us get through this safely. Instead, we're right back where we started. The cases are rising faster than they were back in March, and all of that effort that people went through and the sacrifice they made has essentially been wasted, because the federal government didn't meet its responsibility to lead the country in terms of the infrastructure necessary to control it. Now the thing is out of control, and it's spreading apparently into the Midwest. And, it's hard to know how we're going to stop it today. Everybody wants a vaccine, but realistically that probably won't be until the beginning of next year, we hope. The economic effects are going to be enormous and simply going to be magnified if we don't maintain some level of support to individuals, states, municipalities, across the board. And I'm uncomfortable spending all this money, but to not spend it and have the economy contract even more will be more damaging to the federal budget than trying to fix it. We learned at the beginning of the Great Depression that in a situation like this, trying to avoid spending federal money is a mistake that will only make it worse. By the way, I was walking through the hall at the elevators the other day, and one of my Republican colleagues was being interviewed and saying that he was tired of spending all this money and we had to balance the budget and everything. And I shouldn't have done it, but I shouted, "So why'd you vote for the unfunded tax bill?" But, I just couldn't resist. And then I got in the elevator and the doors closed. That was the end of that conversation. Mm-hmm.
It's July 31st. This is our month in review program. Senator Angus King has joined us for a few minutes. Also with us, Ben Bragdon from the Kennebec Journal and Greg Kesich with the Portland Press Herald. This month had so many things happen, one of which is that the governor has continually rolled out changes in the reopening plan. We saw Governor Mills increase the size of outdoor gatherings to 100 people. We've now found out how we're going to spend some of the money that's coming from the federal government, money aimed toward renters starting next week, money aimed to closing the racial disparities. Greg, as you look back in the month and you look at how the state has reopened or has not reopened, what are your reflections?
You know, I think I always come back to the low infection rate and the low positivity rates on the testing. And I think that's the proof that the steps that the state's been taking are working. You know, it's a little concerning as we open up to more people from other states. And, you know, I question whether people, visitors, are really complying with all the rules regarding quarantining and testing. But, you know, so far, so good. I think it was wise not to open the bars, which had originally been scheduled for, I think, July 1st. Because the experience we had in other states is that those are real places to transfer a disease. But, you know, so I guess we're gradually reopening, but the economy is not going to come back to where it was until the virus is gone.
Ben?
The thing that stands out to me is that if you know, every state was in the same situation as Maine is right now, and we'd be having a lot different discussions around the economy and around what we needed to do and what we'd be able to do heading into the fall. And that wasn't always obvious. You know, there was a time right after we had beat back that first, you know, the wave in New York and in a few other areas, and where everyone had been locked down for a while, more or less across the country. And the question was, okay, do you reopen now or do you keep this going? And some states went full steam ahead, and Governor Mills kept things focused on public health here in Maine. And there was a real question, you know, do we really need that? We're heading into summer. Can't we open up things more? And we all saw what happened in Florida and Georgia and California and Texas. And, you know, it's hard not to say that, you know, this was the right tact, and that if every other state had followed this through, then we, you know, we'd be in a much better position now, instead of, you know, we're certainly worse off than we were in May as a country. And, you know, and worse off than we were in March. It's just not a good place to be, but at least we're all watching it from Maine, where the, you know, the weather's nice and the cases are really low.
Senator King, what are you hearing in your office? Are there business owners who are frustrated with what's happening in Maine?
Sure. And there especially were at the beginning of the summer, particularly in the hospitality industry. But I have to agree with Ben, and as somebody who's run for office, what the governor did took guts. She was under tremendous pressure and a lot of, you know, public pressure. And I know from businesses, here's the problem that she faced. If she, for example, said bars have to stay closed, which was the right call, if you're a bar owner, you know that your income is going away. What you don't know is that order may save your sister's life. It's hard to measure lives saved, but you know, if you look at the data, I look at the data every morning. There's a chart I get every morning of every state and what the trend is, both in cases and deaths. Maine is in the top three or four, the best states in the country every day, and it's because we've done it right, and the governor stuck to her guns under a lot of pressure. So, as one politician to another, I'm very impressed by her willingness to follow the science. And, you know, you look at what's happening in the rest of the country, and as Ben says, what's happening in Maine, we find out today, it looks like we're going to have our schools reopen. If we were in the same shape as Tennessee or Arizona or Florida, opening the schools would be practically impossible. So I give her a lot of credit.
All right. Well, Senator King, thanks so much for joining us for a little bit during our program. I know you have other things you need to do, so we'll say goodbye to you and to the rest of our audience. Greg Kesich and Ben Bragdon will still be with us when we come back, and we will also be speaking with a shark expert about the fatal shark attack in the Mid-Coast. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from The Milk House, a Maine dairy farm in Monmouth, whose organic yogurt, milk, meat, and eggs are available at their on-farm store open daily, Maine Milk House. Roosevelt Campobello International Park, a legacy of friendship between two great nations. Looking forward to welcoming visitors soon. More at fdr.net. And Evergreen Home Performance, helping homeowners manage basement moisture problems with encapsulation and sump pump installation. More at evergreenyourhome.com.
I'm Emily Fang, NPR's Beijing correspondent. I've been a journalist here for almost 4 years. When I first started reporting on the coronavirus outbreak, I knew it would be a big story. Masks were disappearing off shelves, people were canceling their one trip home during Lunar New Year, which is the most important holiday in China, new cases were quickly climbing, and even doctors were starting to get sick. Public radio brought you this story from the get-go because we prioritize reporting on the ground all over the world. And we don't just parachute in when news breaks. We're already there. NPR and this station can invest in this reporting thanks to your continued support. The coronavirus pandemic is just one example of how international stories become local ones for your community. You can support this work by becoming a sustaining member of this station today. Here's how.
Our summer supporter drive, Pledge from Home, starts Wednesday, or you can pledge right now at mainpublic.org. And thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the top news stories in Maine from the month of July. With me today, Greg Kesich with the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram, and Ben Bragdon with the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. We invite you to be part of the conversation with a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling. You can put a comment on our Facebook page or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. On the line with us now, James Sulikowski, a professor at Arizona State University, where he runs the Shark and Fish Conservation Lab, previously based, though, at University of New England, and you continue to conduct research on sharks in Maine, I understand. Professor, thanks for giving us a call.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You know, we were all so shocked and saddened this week by the idea of a fatal shark attack in Maine. It's sort of one of those things that has never happened. We feel so confident will not happen. Were you surprised?
Well, I think everybody was shocked to see that it happened. And, you know, condolences to the family. I mean, I can't even imagine what they're going through. So, you know, how do you, you know, think and deal with that? It's really hard. But the fact is that, you know, white sharks have been in Maine waters for hundreds of years, if not thousands. And, you know, they eat seals, and seals are along our coasts. So oftentimes that predator-prey relationship ends in a mistaken identification, and a human, unfortunately, gets kind of caught in the middle. So it is shocking to see it happen, but it's one of those things that, you know, when you put those in the mix, it can.
Right. And you refer to them as white sharks. I think popular culture will say a great white shark, but we're talking about the same
right.
thing, correct? Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, you are. Yep.
How many are there in our waters in these months, in July, August, September, when they are moving in our waters? Are we talking dozens, hundreds?
We don't know that. That's the one of the $1 million questions, right, that we really are interested in answering. White sharks are an interesting kind of shark in that they're very mobile. You know, there's a lot of work done on the Cape with Atlantic White Shark Conservancy and Dr. Greg Scomo, who we collaborate with, and we know that their sharks can leave the Cape on a Sunday and be up here in Maine on Monday, if not sooner. So they're moving around all the time. How many are there? I mean, there could be 10, 20, 30, 100. Who knows? What we do know is that they're here and they're taking advantage of our large seal population.
I've seen reporting this week that it is the large seal population that likely brought this white shark in so close to shore. It's hard to believe it doesn't have anything to do, though, with the warming waters. Is that at all not really a part of the reason that sharks may be more of them may have been spotted recently?
So if we're talking about the white shark, the great white shark, the climate change had nothing to do with them being here. They've been here for hundreds, again, thousands of years. They've always been here. And sharks are an opportunistic group. And if there is a chance to find food or a nice habitat, then they're going to take that. And right now, there seems to be a lot of seals, a growing population, and white sharks are taking advantage of that.
Is the fact that the population of seals is growing, is that related to climate change?
That, again, you'd have to kind of track those numbers. And my understanding is that since the Marine Mammal Protection Act has been enacted, we're getting these increases in seal population. So is that directly related to climate change? I would have to say probably not.
All right. Well, Jim, before we let you go, I want to ask you about people who want to recreate on the water. I have a lot of friends who are swimmers who swim in a wetsuit. They're not doing that right now. What about paddleboarding, going out in a kayak? Would you have any hesitation?
You know, that's another big question that's kind of come back and forth. But it all comes down to risk and what you're individually comfortable with. You know, we get in a car every day, and that's a risk that we're going to get in an accident, but we don't think about it. And I think that we take precautions. We all wear seatbelts. We don't speed. We don't go through stop signs. So, you know, we mitigate that. If you're on a paddleboard, don't go swimming or you know, paddling or do anything like that in a seal where there's seals or a seal haulout or where there it's dawn or dusk. Doing those things will reduce your risk of some sort of incident happening. You know, often here, you know, don't go swimming in waters that are, you know, above your waist. That'll reduce your risk as well. But I would say that just be aware of your surroundings and make sure that, you know, you know that there's no seals and no big bait balls. And the normal human being who goes to the way to the beach should never have a problem.
James, thank you so much for joining us. Jim Sulikowski is a professor at Arizona State University who conducts research on sharks in Maine. We'll go to a call that's been hanging on for a while, going to Kim in Cumberland. Hi, Kim. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Great. The question was more for Senator King. I don't know if anyone can answer it. I just... solution. So many parents were also concerned about schools, same as teachers, and I'm wondering why we haven't chosen to do a very solid quarantine just before school starts, particular with Anthony Fauci saying that places in Europe were 95% quarantined and the United States was only 50%. Has that been discussed, and does anyone else see the merit to that?
Sure, Kim. Thanks for your call. Ben and Greg, I'm going to throw this out to you. I wasn't able to listen to Governor Mills' press conference leading up to the program. Were you?
No, I was not.
No, yeah, I wasn't able to. I know, I know that they feel they set these, you know, kind of parameters for opening the schools, based on a number of the indicators. And they feel like those indicators are low enough to be able to safely open schools. You know, you have to get make sure that the number of cases in your community is low, not only to keep someone from passing on the virus, but also if someone does, to be able to track and trace it quickly. And you can't do that if you have a lot of cases. As far as a shutdown, I think there have been people increasingly calling over the last couple weeks for a nationwide shutdown, looking at how we are, behind where we were a couple months ago and saying, all right, let's stop fooling around. Let's just shut this down for a few weeks once and for all, get everybody to where we can, handle and get our arms around the virus. But there certainly doesn't seem to be the will to do that nationwide, and I don't think that you could pull it off in Maine. It just seems like people are are kind of doing as much as they're willing to do to stop the spread of the virus right now. And, you know, it would be hard to go bigger than that.
Kim, thanks for your call. We're going to go now to Sarah Craighead Dedman, who's the editor of the Machias Valley News Observer. Sarah, thanks for giving us a call.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for having me.
I understand in your part of Maine, lobster season is swinging into high gear and the pogies are running. Is that the news of the month of July in Machias?
Well, like most of the state, our news has been heavily focused on COVID. And of course, right now we're looking at our school reopening plans and things. But the pogies are big news. They will be a front page story next week because they haven't been here in decades. So we're seeing quite a lot of recreational line fishermen along the Machias River. And I initially thought they were fishing for the pogies. But the DMR scientist I spoke to yesterday said that they actually taste terrible, that people don't eat them, but that they're fishing for the things that prey on the pogies, which are also called menhaden more formally, and things like striped bass and haddock and pollock. So the last time they were here in the Downeast region was the 1990s.
Oh, wow. That is big news.
Yeah,
Sarah, what else?
Eels, yeah.
What else is big news in your part of the state?
Well, this is the first time that Washington County's COVID-19 case count has crossed the threshold so that the CDC could release zip code data. That happened earlier this week. And so that's big news. We've gotten up to 7 confirmed cases, obviously a fairly low number by most standards. That was something that most of the public here seemed to be kind of clamoring for throughout the pandemic, wanting to know where the risk areas were. But now it's met with more of a mixed reaction, people feeling like it's an invasion of privacy. Of course, privacy is not invaded, or the CDC wouldn't have released it. But it's been a hot topic on the social media sites.
Oh, I'm sure. I can see that. Has there been because there have been more cases, is there a change in the attitude towards, for example, wearing facial coverings?
Absolutely. I think early in the pandemic, by my estimation, we had a very low adoption rate of just thumbing it around 20% when you would go to the grocery store. And we do only have like one major grocery store right here in Machias. And now when I go in, it's greater than 90%, maybe 95%. So really high adoption rate that has grown up over, I'd say, the last month.
All right. Before I let you go, I understand a new sober house in Washington County. Important.
Yeah, this is great. This is really big news for our recovery community. Obviously, we, like so many counties, are struggling, you know, to help our recovery community. And a group of nonprofits have come together, and they're about to open the doors just in a week or two here, I think. Maybe I'm pushing them, but very soon on a women's sober house that will also allow children. And that's the really big part of it. So that mothers, you know, wanting to be with their children, you know, they can still do that and it wouldn't be a barrier to recovery. And it's actually opening on the same street, Elm Street, which also has a Suboxone clinic and a faith-based recovery center. So Machias is really kind of gathering some resources for that fight.
Sarah, thank you so much for calling Maine calling today and letting us see the view from down east Maine. Sarah Craighead Dedman is the editor of the Machias Valley News Observer. Greg and Ben, because this is such an unusual show, because we had Governor King at the top, we haven't even talked about the July primary yet. I don't think it was any surprise that Sarah Gideon won the Democratic primary for Senate, Greg, but I was a little surprised at just the pace at which the entire November election campaign surged. The next day, the ads that came out over social media, over television, the change in tone. What about you?
Yeah, you know, I was wondering about that race because there was so little public polling. I was wondering if anything had changed, you know, if in the dynamic in terms of people wanting more progressive policies. She was running against much more, you know, progressive candidates. And it was pretty clear, you know, just as she was acting, she was acting like she was way ahead, and she was way ahead. So I think the fall campaign had really kicked in before the primary had, you know, been the votes counted. But yeah, no, this is like one of the most watched races in the country. The control of the U.S. Senate is in the balance. It's got a lot of money coming from outside on both sides because, you know, both parties want to hold on to the seat. It's unlike any other race we've seen with Senator Collins because she is so tied with her party and with particularly with the president of her party in a way that it's never been before. She ran very independently from other presidential candidates, John McCain, who was a good friend of hers. She ran his campaign here. But if you look at the results, about a third of her voters were Obama voters. And the same in earlier on when the first time she ran with Bob Dole, she outperformed the Republican at the top of the ticket. But you look at the polling that's come out in the last few months, and her numbers and Donald Trump's numbers are almost identical in Maine.
Ben, do you see any themes developing?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, you know, President Trump dominates the news every day, and he's probably going to dominate the election, and that a lot of the election is going to be about him, whether people want it to be or not. Senator Collins isn't answering questions about whether she's supporting him in the election, but that hardly doesn't seem to really matter. That his voters are already connected, connecting her with him, and you know, probably a sign too that everyone's just becoming more of a kind of like a party line voter. And that, someone like Susan Collins on the Republican side taking a 20-point victory just isn't going to happen anymore.
We are going to take another quick break. It's the Month in Review program. It's Friday, July 31st. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from MDI Hospital and Health Centers, dedicated to strengthening the health of their patients and their community. MDIHospital.org. Alt eStore, providing solar power, battery backup equipment, and advice to solar installers and DIYers since 1999. Alt eStore. And the Camden Opera House, presenting the Sound Check concert series, live and live streamed. Details at CamdenOperaHouse.com. On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
The town of Kennebunk was incorporated on July 31, 1820. First settled in 1621, the town developed as a trading and later shipbuilding and shipping center with light manufacturing. It had previously been part of the towns of Wells and Arundel. Kennebunk, the only village in the world so named, was featured on a large, locally famous sign attached to the Kesslin Shoe Mill. To the local Abenaki, Kennebunk meant the Long Cut Bank, for a distinct land formation near the sea which may have served as a navigational aid.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Roosevelt Campobello International Park and the Island Institute. Happy birthday, Maine! On the next Speaking in Maine, an evening with Hillary Clinton.
Last thing we're going to need this upcoming election is any questions about the outcome. That is just another body blow to our democracy if we don't get this right.
Join former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton as she discusses the consequences before us as we vote in the next election. This program is one of many from the 2020 Champlain Institute at College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor. That's Friday afternoon at 2. Here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today, we're talking about news stories from the past month. My guests are Ben Bragdon with the Kennebec Journal and Greg Kessage with the Portland Press Herald. And we are joined now by another newspaper editor from the York County Co-Star, Stephen Porter. Stephen, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
How is the summer tourism season going for the York County coast?
Well, I think it is safe to say that we've certainly seen an uptick in activity through July compared to what we saw to a bit slower start to the season due to the pandemic. I'm not sure that we've returned to normal, so to speak, but there are definitely quite a few people enjoying the beaches these days.
We've seen in the Portland area, beloved restaurants announced that they're closing forever. Now the Port City Music Hall. Is that kind of thing happening in the communities that you cover?
We have had some closures of eateries. I'm not sure how many of them have actually been permanent at this point, but I know that there are quite a few that are concerned about it becoming permanent. So that's something that we're keeping an eye on, because I know quite a few have been very concerned about that.
I'm sure you heard before our break, Greg and Ben and myself talking about the primary election. What's the perspective from there? How did York County turn out, and what are your thoughts on how the primary election went, not only in terms of how smooth it was, but the outcome as well?
Oh, definitely. We talked to a lot of local voters about the Senate race, for example, and I know that some Democrats were really hoping for a more progressive candidate than Sarah Gideon. We talked to some who expressed that. But we also talked to some who had voted previously for Collins and were really attracted to Gideon as a moderate. So I think that the trends in York County really reflected statewide as far as that's concerned. I think I was actually a bit surprised that things ran so smoothly, though, because with all the absentee ballots that were counted, I kind of figured that there would be a bit more of a hassle tallying those up on election night. But we really didn't see that in York County.
Well, Stephen, thanks for giving us a call today. Stephen Porter, main editor for Seacoast Online and editor of the York County Coast Star. We've talked about the U.S. Senate race, Greg, but we haven't talked about the 2nd Congressional District. People really didn't know. There had been one poll, but it wasn't a very big poll showing Dale Crafts in the lead. It did go to recount, but it was clear from the beginning that Crafts was going to win this primary race. I'm wondering, one, why you think that was? Was it because of Governor LePage's support or because of other reasons? And two, will it be a tight race come November?
It's a hard, in terms of why Crafts won over the other two, it's a hard one to say. Like you said, there was very little polling. I think there was one poll months out. You know, just watching them on the forums, the forum that you did, he was clearly a more mature person, genial. You know, the other two were getting involved in some real backbiting, and he, for the most part, stayed out of that and was like a better, you know, presence, seemed like a more reasonable presence on the stage. That might have helped. He certainly had the support of Governor LePage. He also comes out of the Christian community and has access to a church network that is always very powerful in Republican primaries. So it's probably a combination of things. Will it be a close race? It probably will. I mean, it was a close race last time when Jared Golden won with ranked choice voting. It's going to be an interesting race. I think, if Crafts were to be elected for the 2nd District, he would be among the most conservative people in the United States Congress. His position on abortion, he favors privatizing Social Security. I think those things would make him much more conservative than the people who have represented the district in the past. It's always, they always say that a congressman's first reelection is the most difficult. That's the one where they're most likely to be unseated. So this is the first time out for Golden as an incumbent.
Sure. And Ben, do you see Golden as vulnerable? Ben, are you there?
Whoops.
Oh, I'm sorry. He's certainly vulnerable. It was a very close race that he won over Bruce Polquin, about as close as it can get. And that second district is still very conservative. Jared Golden's got around a lot in 2 years. You've seen him try to kind of walk the fence on a lot of things. He's not the quickest to come out against Republicans or President Trump. He's often, you know, when he cast a vote for impeachment, he kind of split the baby and voted one and the other, and he was the only one to split the impeachment or voting on the impeachment articles. And so you can see that he knows he's in a district where being a Democrat can be, can make it difficult. The latest Colby poll we have, has him up 45-33 with a lot of undecided, and that'll change as more people get to know Dale Crafts. But it also had Joe Biden up by 3 points in the second district. That's really bad news for President Trump, and fairly good news for Jerry Golden.
We'll go to Elizabeth calling from Portland. Hi, Elizabeth. Go ahead.
Hi. So I am a Portland Public Schools parent, and I also have a 3-year-old child. And I'm very interested in what the panelists think about school reopening, which, as you've just heard, all counties in the state have been classified as green, and how that will work for working parents if it's a hybrid model, and if the idea of direct payments to vulnerable families has been floated at all in this time. Thanks.
Elizabeth, I think you're asking one of the million-dollar questions. Greg?
Three of the million-dollar questions. let's see if I can remember them all. The thing about payments to families, I don't know that was in the House bill. It certainly isn't in the Senate Republican bill that was floated this week. The question of how working families are going to manage a hybrid system where a child is in school maybe 2 days a week, good question. It sounds like a real nightmare for families. It's, but you know, I think it will really impact people's ability to go back to work if you know their work is available, or you know, people say they can work from home, but working from home and supervising a child, or anything like I was as a child doing schoolwork, I needed a lot of attention. And it would have been hard to do that at a job. The question about opening the schools, I think is just generally a positive one. I think we can be happy that the infection rate is low. She is calling from Portland, which is one of the most likely places in the state to transmit the disease. So I guess that's a concern, but for the most part, our infection rate is low, and opening the schools is not they're not going to return to normal to where they were in February. They still will have to meet very strict standards in terms of hygiene and spacing and social distancing hand washing stations, a number of criteria, But generally, I think it's a good thing that schools can reopen and kids can get back to school and back to some kind of normal education.
Elizabeth, thanks for your question. And, you know, obviously this time next month and the month after will be probably the end of September, talking about how it all has gone. Ben, but it's sort of a reflection, Governor Mills just making that announcement today, of how quickly the news is coming at us right now and how challenging it is to keep it all straight and keep it into perspective for our listeners.
Yeah, I think, as we head into this new school year, I think we have to keep saying over and over again that we've never done this before, and that that no matter how hard the schools work and how everyone gets this stuff together, we just don't know how it's going to go. We don't know how the learning is going to go in the schools, and we don't know how parents are going to handle this hybrid situation. We don't know what's going to happen with cases come fall. We don't know what's going to happen in other states. It's it is going to be a moment-to-moment thing, and it's going to require all of us to be flexible and be understanding. And it's also going to require a lot of help for businesses that can't open, for individuals that can't get to work, for people that can't find childcare. It's you can't understate the scope of this problem and the scope of the, what we're going through and how unique it is and how uncertain we are about it. And I think we do good to remember that this is all very uncertain and can change on a minute. And we just need to keep everybody's health in mind with each decision. And hopefully
Thank
we
you,
can.
Ben. I have to cut you off. That's Ben Bragdon with the Kennebec Journal. Greg Kasich also here with the Portland Press Herald. Main Calling produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Lucy Suchek ran the board. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Public Radio.